Thank you very much, Vivian Traynor, and this is Saturday with Justin McCarthy. You're very welcome to the programme. Our panel today is Michael D'Arcy, Fine Gael TD and Minister of State at the Department of Finance, Billy Kelleher, Fianna Fáil TD for Cork North Central and Party Spokesman on Health, Roisin Shortall, co-leader of the Social Democrats, Mary Regan, political commentator and journalist with the Sunday Business Post, and John Downing, political correspondent with the Irish Independent. You're all very welcome to the studio. Now, this week we saw the two politicians at the top of the government outlining different positions on the question of abortion. Both Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney said that while they would both support repeal of the Eighth Amendment, the Taoiseach has voiced his opposition to this proposal to legislate for unrestricted abortion in the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. John Downing, you've been following this position outlined by Simon Coveney. Yeah. How much of a problem is it for the Taoiseach and for Simon Harris?
I think it's a difficulty. Basically, on Monday night, the Taoiseach outlined his position. We expect a referendum in late May, and that basically the proposal is to remove the Eighth Amendment from 1983, dating from 1983, and in parallel, we will get legislation which expects to have unlimited access to abortion up to 12 weeks of pregnancy. We expect the scheme of that bill to be published late next month. The difficulty is the Taoiseach is determined that you can split the two of these issues and that the repeal issue will be separate from the legislation. I find that very difficult to see.
The Taoiseach is saying that, yes.
Well, the Taoiseach's position was also that, you know, please vote for repeal. But the point is, the campaign will be heavily about what will replace repeal de facto, which will be this parallel legislation. Now, the Taoiseach is of the view, Simon Coveney says, yeah, I can support repeal, but not the issue of 12 weeks. So there are many others. It's very finely poised at the moment, the issue of 12 weeks. A lot of TDs have yet to declare their position.
He's not alone in this, though.
He's by no means alone.
Yeah, so he seems to have introduced this third way now, that you can support repeal of the Eighth Amendment but be against the 12 weeks.
Absolutely,
which,
yeah.
Which is something that the government hadn't really, you know, this was not in the grand plan.
Well, no, I mean, and it's a bad start for the Taoiseach. I know this is a very divisive and difficult and very personal issue, but the politics of it are such that the Taoiseach, the first day he was elected as Taoiseach, he identified this as a priority. And I think it would be a considerable political prize for him to resolve an issue which has conflicted the nation for 35 years. I think unity within his own camp would have been very helpful to him. I find he's in difficulty on this issue.
Billy Kelleher, I think you were the person who first introduced the idea of support for the 12-week, the 12-week cut-off point at the committee which examined the Eighth Amendment. Am I right there?
Yes, well, I mean, we heard all the evidence. We were asked to adjudicate on the Citizens' Assembly report. Bear in mind, the Citizens' Assembly recommended 22 weeks in terms of socioeconomic, in the areas of incest and rape and right across the board. So, I mean, the report that was published by the Oireachtas Committee is much more restrictive than that was recommended by the Citizens' Assembly. But the reality here is, and I mean, the Taoiseach isn't a difficulty in this sense, along with many other people, let's be very clear, it's very personal and emotive for individuals. But the bottom line here is nothing can happen unless repeal takes place. In other words, you know, you can have all the sympathy and compassion for people who are victims of rape, who have been impregnated by their father, who have, life-limiting conditions themselves, who simply need a termination for whatever reason. And if the repeal doesn't take place, we are back at the status quo, and that will mean all of those challenges that we have will have to go to England, as is the case now. And we have the other issue around the 12 weeks, and this really is where we came to a final conclusion on the 12 weeks. There's about 1,800 girls, women, every year in this country for the last number of years, will put a towel in the bathroom in their house and self-administer a tablet and induce a miscarriage up to 12 weeks. Now, the idea that we can pretend that these things aren't happening in our bedrooms across the country, to me, is just not possible anymore. So I think we have to be honest with ourselves, and that's what the committee did. I just want to say, finally, the committee did not look at focus groups. It did not look at research or polling. It looked at the evidence that was presented to us by experts, and we came to those adjudications not to make it easy on the politicians or on anybody else, but to give them the facts as is.
But what about this position that's now being advocated by Simon Coveney and others, that you can support repeal of the 8th but be against the 12-week proposal? Does that create a new element of confusion into the debate? Because the government, as John said, the government will publish the general scheme of the bill, the legislation, and isn't that what people are going to look at when they go to vote?
Well, they are, and I said this in the Dáil, and I said at the committee as well. I mean, the reality here is that many people would want a more unrestricted abortion regime in this country. There were people at the committee who supported the 22 weeks. There were people who supported the 24 weeks. No government at this stage can guarantee anything in terms of the legislation that will flow other than what is published as a template, because no party has a majority in the Dáil. So, I mean, you know, what we're asking the Irish people is to, from my perspective, is to repeal the 8th Amendment and to allow for legislation to flow from that. The template that is recognised is the one that was published by the Oireachtas in terms of the 12 weeks. But it is a restrictive form of abortion compared to most other European countries. And, you know, it talks about the reasons, the complexities of defining incest and rape, proving those. So that's why we came to that determination on the 12 weeks. But after that, it is very restrictive in the areas of disability and the health of the woman, for example.
Michael Darcy, you've said in the past that you are opposed to abortion. Have you formulated your view now? Have you heard anything from maybe what Simon Coveney said during the week, which would, which would give you some comfort that you know there is another way being proposed?
Yeah, it's such a difficult question for everybody. I've said that in the past, and I'm still in that space. I am opposed to abortion, but I always made the point that the 92 referendum, if people remember, there were three questions. The people of Ireland came up with an Irish solution. They voted against abortion, but they voted for information and for people's right to travel. And the committee have done a lot of good work, and I'm working my way through the evidence. I didn't have the opportunity to sit through it all. But I know from
speaking... Where do you stand at the moment?
I will vote for the referendum to go ahead, unquestionably. And do I support repeal? I haven't concluded my own mindset just yet. I want to go through the evidence. I want to inform myself fully. When I inform myself fully and I see the legislation, I will take a position. I will indicate exactly what I intend doing and the reasons behind that at that stage.
And will you be basing your vote or your level of support on what's in that legislation? Because some TDs clearly are not going to do that. If you take Simon Coveney's position, for example, he's saying that, OK, the 12 weeks may be in the legislation, but we'd look to change that afterwards. Would you be thinking along the same lines?
Yeah, that's a real issue. And there's no point in trying to pretend that the 12 weeks can become something else and it may not be decided by the Oireachtas. And the courts can intervene and they can then, you can have, you know, the hugely, hugely unfortunate case that will end up with the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will interpret the legislation in a different way than perhaps the Oireachtas will have intended. That's happened before. We've seen, you know, just cases that you wouldn't be able to make up, present to the courts. And the courts have found a certain position.
That is true, Michael, of many forms of legislation.
No,
there will be court cases flowing from any law you bring in. You can't kind of see around corners every time.
I'm not trying to see around the corner, but equally you can't ignore that this is a very emotive issue. I don't support abortion.
Neither do I, to be honest. Neither do I. But I mean, the reality is, I mean, the report that was published shows that at least 3,500 women a year go abroad.
As I said,
1,800 in Ireland. And I said, I don't support it either, but I live in a world where we actually have to address this issue.
I haven't concluded my way
what through. What I'm trying to understand, though, are you moving now from your original position of not supporting abortion to a point where there may be support there under certain conditions?
I'm not moving yet. And I'm not moving until I fully inform myself. And it's one of the things that I think people should do. They should fully inform themselves. They should read the evidence from the committee. They should go through the transcripts and they should read the report. And if people make their determination with a fully informed mind from whatever side, you know, but that's a good thing. But people should be fully informed.
Roisin Shortall, Are you concerned that maybe the Taoiseach may have introduced a lack of clarity in there, or is there a possibility that clearly you're in favour of repeal of the Eighth Amendment? Is there a possibility that Simon Coveney, what he did during the week, may bring bring some of his supporters towards supporting repeal?
I think there is a real danger that it will cause confusion in the minds of a lot of people. And that needs to be addressed, really, because, you know, Michael says he's not in favour of abortion. There aren't many people who are in favour of abortion, but it is a reality of life in Ireland. And I think the Oireachtas Committee did a very good job. You know, they engaged very intensely with this issue. They listened to all the evidence and, you know, they reflected, I believe, the views of a lot of people who feel very strongly that it's not tenable to continue with the present arrangement because there are too many cases that arise that cannot be dealt with within the context of a constitutional provision, and that needs to go. And I think there's a very strong level of public opinion in favour of repealing the Eighth Amendment and legislating. So a lot of people are of that view. But the question is, what happens next? And as we see in today's Irish Times, about a third of TDs are undecided at this point. Now, I think there's there might be an element of just waiting to see what way the wind is blowing. But there's also an element, I think, of people who haven't themselves engaged in the thing and thought it through. And I think that's the case to some extent in relation to Simon Coveney. Like, I heard him on the airwaves during the week and talking about being in favour of repeal, but not in favour of the committee's proposals. So what is he in favour of then? Like, you know, this isn't an easy thing to legislate for. And the committee, I think, really grappled very seriously with it. And in my view, they came up with the proposals on three grounds. The first is that, you know, a 12-week cut-off period for unrestricted abortion is the minimum that is the case in across Europe. It's the absolute minimum. Secondly, they obviously dealt with the issue of, again, a thing that I think the vast majority of Irish people would favour, and that is a situation where somebody is raped or is the victim of incest. And I think there are very few people who would attempt to dictate to someone else if they found themselves in that situation about what they should do. And I think there's strong public support for people in those circumstances to be able to have access to abortion. But the third ground, if I could say, is, I suppose, new information that has come to light generally that a lot of people haven't been aware of, and that is the widespread use of the abortion pill, which, as Billy has said, nearly 2,000 Irish women are accessing over the internet and taking without any medical supervision of that. And that's a reality that needs to be dealt with.
So those were the reasons why they came up with the 12-week proposal. I want to go to the telephone to John Paul Phelan, the Fine Gael TD for Carlo Kilkenny. John Paul Phelan, you're one of the people who has made up their mind to, and you want to retain the Eighth Amendment. Did you hear anything from Simon Coveney during the week and this suggestion from him that the 12-week proposal could be removed? Did you hear anything in that which would change your view now?
No, well, my position isn't that I want retention of the current system. I mean, there are plenty of examples, and I agree with most of what I heard from previous speakers there, of situations where the current law doesn't cater for people, particularly actually in the situation of what's called fatal fetal abnormality, if a child isn't going to live, that we put people through, I suppose, extra hardship in this state. I favour amending the amendment, but of course there are different versions of amending the amendment. But I do think that, like, this discussion so far has been pretty respectful. Political parties have made it clear that members can, you know, express their own view. Simon Coveney's comments, I heard them the other day. I really can't for the life of me understand the surprise. Simon Coveney has expressed similar views to this for years. We had this discussion hot and heavy, I suppose, in Fine Gael 5 years ago, and his views were similar then to what they are now. I mean, if we're to have the debate where people can express their own opinion and the public can vote in a referendum to see what's in their constitution, then surely all members of the Oireachtas are entitled to their view the same as the general public. We don't all have to conform together.
And what about the message then that's going to go out, that there are now three camps among TDs and in your own party? There's those who support repeal, those who support repeal but oppose the 12-week unrestricted proposal, and then those who oppose repeal of the Eighth Amendment. Does that create the fact that there isn't, you know, I suppose a binary position being adopted, does that create confusion?
Well, again, I would say people can hardly be surprised. I mean, if we're arriving at a position where members of the Oireachtas are allowed a free vote and can, you know, state their own position, then surely it is not surprising that people express different opinions. This is very reflective of where the general public are on this issue. I mean, you talk to anybody on the street, bar the extreme views, most people believe that there has to be change, but it's the scope of that change, and it's the issue is the 12 weeks the potential that might have to, you know, introduce a whole new regime in this country. And people are concerned about that, and I think that the Taoiseach just expressed the view of a great many people in his comments the other day.
All right, John Paul Feeney, I'm going to let you go because I know you have to go now. Mary Regan, the Taoiseach and the Minister for Health, when they held their press conference at 10 o'clock on Monday evening, they spoke about providing clarity for people. What's your view of what has happened since?
Well, I think the easy part in many ways here was going to be getting an answer from the Irish public on whether to repeal the Eighth Amendment or not. The hard part was always going to be coming up with the question, and which would include the legislation, what would be put in place if the Eighth Amendment was repealed. And I think, you know, we're further away as we ever were from having an answer to what will be put in place, despite almost 2 years now at this stage between the Citizens Assembly and the Oireachtas Committee looking into this over the course of a couple of months. What we see now is a lot of Fine Gael TDs sort of holding their views or not making up their mind until such point as Simon Harris publishes the heads off bill that will be at the end of March.
Which is Michael's position here.
Yeah, so what I'm picking up from some Fine Gael TDs who would be, let's say, in the Simon Coveney camp on this issue is that they want to see that legislation published, and then they will seek some kind of compromise after that legislation is published so that the party and the government can go to the public with a position saying, if we vote to repeal the Eighth Amendment, this is what will be put in place. Now, to me, that looks like a very difficult process that they'll engage into, because that will be the end of March. The Taoiseach is promising that a referendum will be held in the end of May. So that gives 2 months really to come up with a compromise position which would suit the Coveney camp and what Leo Varadkar is saying. That's 2 months to come up with a compromise that on an issue that's been examined for a year and a half at least at this stage. So it's a very ambitious timeline at this stage to have a referendum at the end of May.
Let's put that point to Michael Darcy. Is that what's going to happen? Do you think, Michael, that perhaps when the legislation is published, that there will be a move to try and amend it before it's put out there as the legislation that people are going to that TDs are going to adopt, should there be repeal?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think the position that has flowed from the Oireachtas Committee that the government have accepted will become much more apparent at that stage. I think it will be the 12 weeks access or not.
Yes, but what happens then if repeal of the if the Eighth Amendment is repealed, and if you have, as you have now, a sizable number of TDs, if you have a majority of TDs who actually don't accept that position, are you going to see a position then where TDs would vote against what may have been the will of the people in a referendum?
Yeah, I think we're jumping a lot of hurdles early. I think we have to wait and see what the legislation is. I'm not predicting what Mary is predicting. My sense of it will be it'll be very close to what the committee presented.
I think it's important that people are just challenged on this to some extent. I mean, we heard John Paul Phelan talking there about being opposed to repeal, and then he talks about the case of fatal abnormality. Like, it's not possible legally to deal with those cases as long as the Eighth Amendment exists and continues to exist.
But I think what he talked about was amending the amendment.
But you can't do that, and that's been made very clear. You know, you can't deal with a situation like that unless you go back to the people. And, you know, that, obviously there's a case of fatal abnormality, but there are those other real life situations as well. And I'd say, you know, Simon Coveney needs to be asked about this. How does he propose to deal with the situation where somebody becomes pregnant after rape or incest? Like, what is his proposal? If he's saying that it should be the constitution should be amended, but what kind of legislation then is he talking about?
I think he did outline in part his proposal on that was that a woman who was the victim of a rape would go to a GP who could then sign the form.
And how would a GP adjudicate on that? Do you know, I mean, how do you establish legally that somebody has been raped? You cannot do it within a 12-week period or, you know, longer than that. Somebody was just remarking there in the media that the average, or it was Noel Whelan, he said the average length of time that it takes to convict a rapist is almost 2 years.
Isn't that the problem, though, John Downing, that you have now got, we have the set of carefully considered options by the committee on the 8th.
Yeah.
You have those who have an ideological objection, yes, to removing the 8th Amendment. Yeah. And then you have a group of TDs who are forming their own views and putting forward these ad hoc solutions.
Yeah, yeah, and that is a big difficulty. And that is the history of referendums is... They can be defeated or stopped in their tracks by sowing doubt and confusion. And the current situation is a good opportunity, a boon for those who will oppose this referendum. Because if you sow enough doubt among the voters in what's already a complicated and divisive issue, people will either decide not to vote or they'll go for the default, if in doubt, leave it out.
That is the political difficulty here for Leo Varadkar, because in putting the question to the Irish people, he has to say what will be put in place, you know, if this is repealed, because otherwise he's asking people to vote in a vacuum, really, and he needs to give the public some guarantee of what will be put in place to do that. But that seems like an impossibility, because he's in a catch-22 situation in many respects, because he can't, you know, have legislation passed until it is repealed, and he can't guarantee the public that this legislation, you know, will pass in the Dáil, particularly considering the current makeup of this Dáil.
And it's happening in your party too, though, Billy, isn't it, that you do have that spread of views, that three-way split as well, where you have people who are opposed to the 8th, yes, who are in favour, and then in favour but opposed to the 12 weeks.
Yes, there is. And as I said, I speak in a personal capacity all the time on this issue, because we have a free vote and they're varying views. But I just, the more I listen to the debate over the last number of weeks and sitting at the committee, it's almost gratuitously offensive to women to suggest that if we introduce in this country 12-week unrestricted, that there's going to be queues of people, women outside abortion clinics across the state. The fact of the matter is that 2,000 women a year self-administer abortion pills, 3,500 go to the UK that we know of. We don't know beyond that. But we do know one thing for sure. They don't travel there lightly. They don't travel there, you know, for a weekend and for a hen party in the way. These are women who are in turmoil. And like the idea that we will just, you know, open up the floodgates if we introduce in this country, we won't. What we'll do is we'll treat our women in this country rather than forcing them to go to other countries. That's the purpose of it. But none of this can happen. None of this can happen unless the 8th Amendment is repealed or substantially amended. None of this can happen. And that includes rape, fatal abnormality. And the other thing, finally, just the issue of the health of the woman. This can't be dealt with unless we repeal the 8th Amendment as well. So a woman who's in latter stages of kidney failure, a woman who's massive cardiac problems, who needs a termination, otherwise her health will be impaired for a long time. Those issues can't be dealt with unless it's repealed.
In terms of amending it, though, I think most people would accept that the Constitution is not the place to deal with absolutely an issue as complex as abortion. Yes. You know, because there are so many different aspects to this, mm-hmm, that you can't encapsulate that. And, like, goodness knows, over the last 30 years, we should have learned that was a mistake.
What do you say to those arguments, Michael Darcy, as you weigh up your own views?
Yeah, well, as I weigh up my own views, I'm listening to the arguments, and I think over the 35 years, we've had the 83 referendum, we've had the 92 and the 02.
Where three questions were asked in
so we've had 92. five referenda at this stage. Yeah. I think it hasn't worked out well, the 8th Amendment. going back to 1983. People have forgotten that the government withdrew its support for it, and it still went through on that occasion.
But there are those, of course, who would disagree that it hasn't gone well, and many people suggesting that it has saved an awful lot of lives.
And look, people have their views, and I accept their views, and look, this has been a running sore in the Irish society for decades. In 92, we had an Irish solution, as I said, which was people could travel and have information, but they couldn't have it here. The people will decide this. My sense of it is that it will become binary. The question will be repeal the 8 and accept unrestricted access for 12 weeks.
Okay. All right. I'm going to take a break now, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about Nigel Farage's visit to Dublin and Brexit. Welcome back to Saturday with Justin McCarthy. Now, Nigel Farage was on with Marion before this programme, and he's in Dublin today and was here last night as well, speaking at a number of events. He made a number of points last night and during the interview this morning, suggesting that there is support for an Irish exit from the European Union, and also suggesting that the government is taking the wrong approach in siding with Brussels instead of backing a better deal for the UK. Now, on the line is Noel O'Connell, who is Executive Director of European Movement Ireland. Noel, you wanted to pick up on some of the points that Nigel Farage was making there. Obviously, I think you agree that he communicates his points well, but you have difficulty with some of what he has had to say.
Well, thank you, Justin. I think he's a little bit selective in some of his facts or some of the points he's making. I suppose he refers to that there's a demand for Ireland to follow the UK example, like Brexit, and leave the EU when every single poll from either Eurobarometers or Red Sea polls that European Movement Ireland has commissioned and other organisations have shown overwhelming support for Ireland remaining an active and committed member of a reforming European Union. The figures since 2013 have been over the high 80s consistently. They've never reduced.
Yeah, but what about his point that we haven't had a proper discussion about it in Ireland, and that there hasn't been enough debate on that whole idea of an IRA exit?
I would disagree with that, Justin, because I think here in Ireland we've had 9 EU referenda, and I think we are a very informed public on matters pertaining to our membership of the European Union. But we're not beholden to a historical legacy, perhaps, that Nigel Farage was talking about. I mean, if you look in terms of the referendums and the polls and the debate, that is why we in Ireland are having a Future of Europe and a series of citizens' dialogues around the country to get people's views. So he's talking about that a demand exists for an IRA exit. It really doesn't. I mean, 88% of Irish people wanting us to remain a part of the EU. When we asked people in 2013, should Ireland leave the EU if Brexit were to occur, 30% said yes in 2013. That has reduced to 16% last year. So very clearly, there is no public appetite for Ireland to leave the EU, because we are very well aware of the strong benefits being a member of a European Union and a single market of over 500 million customers and consumers brings to Ireland and brings to our businesses and our society.
Yeah. But what about the point he's making that around half of Irish exports from Irish companies, they go to Britain, and for Ireland then to support what may be a bad deal for Britain, that would be insanity from an Irish perspective?
Well, the first thing, I'd prefer to look at the totality, if I may, of Irish exports, because I think that's important. And looking at the CSO figures, 14% of our exports go to the UK, 51% go to the Eurozone area. So
yeah,
that's
but if
important.
You focus on the smaller companies, which are probably, can be more important, particularly outside of the urban areas, and for food products, there's still a huge amount of exports going to the UK from Ireland.
Oh, absolutely. And certainly there is no doubt that Brexit is going to cause significant challenges to Irish business, and particularly the Irish agri-business sector. And I think that was something he didn't really address. Nobody in Ireland wanted Brexit whilst respecting the vote of the UK electorate.
Yes, but isn't his point, though, that we've sided with Brussels, and Brussels wants to punish the UK for its departure, so we're supporting a bad deal for Britain, which isn't in our interests?
Absolutely not. the fact of the matter is the Irish issue through Brexit, which again we didn't want, was prioritised as one of the key priorities in phase one. It is also going to have its own focus and strand in the phase two of the negotiations, which are going on now. So that lack, the solidarity and the support that we have gained from our EU member states has been significant to try and mitigate the negative effects of Brexit. Nobody in Ireland wants a bad deal. It is in Irish interest that the UK gets a good deal for Brexit, but the challenge is aligning the political rhetoric and the practical realities of the UK voting to leave the European Union, voting to distance itself from the single market. I mean, he didn't really address also how he proposes the UK to trade worldwide through a series of 759 treaties and international agreements on everything like aviation to food standards and safety, and how the UK is going to address that once they leave the European Union.
Okay. All right. And Noel O'Connell, Executive Director of European Movement Ireland, thanks for taking our call. Michael Darcy, what about that point that Nigel Farage made around fishing? And he's saying that we've got such a bad deal on fishing that we've actually lost more than we've ever gotten from the EU because of that bad deal.
Yeah, I've heard that line put before, but that doesn't take into consideration the reality. The reality is we now have the IDA figures, just the IDA figures, 230,000 foreign direct investment jobs here. The calculation is always used that for every job, there's another job. So you're almost at 500,000 jobs that are based here. A lot of those jobs are here because of the opportunity to be based in Ireland, to passport into the EU. And the position that I have in terms of financial services, I see financial institutions, companies of every hue and cry in that sector who are now looking to ensure that in 14 or 15 months' time that they have the opportunity to trade their goods, their services, their wares into the EU27. And it's very easy to make a calculation and exclude so many other aspects of the calculation. And Nigel offers opinions as facts. A lot of what he says are his opinion from a very, very one-sided, biased, objective, non-objective view about the European Union. The European Union has been the most successful peace process in probably ever. And it's the first time in 75 years Britain, France and Germany haven't gone to war.
John Downing, you've worked over in Brussels. Does he make a point that we haven't really had the debate properly about whether the EU has been a good thing for Ireland or not?
Yeah, I'm always in favour of debate. In fact, debates pay the rent for me, so why wouldn't I be in favour of them? But I would agree. Probably the only thing was something in the back of my mind saying that sometimes the consensus around the EU can be a little unhealthy and based on a lack of information. We are in a process of trying to have a debate about what kind of future EU Ireland wants. It's 60 years old as a project. High time for fundamental rethinking. But all that being said, the evidence is overwhelming, and we have had 9 referendums. Noel O'Connell is right, and this man really—it's muddle-headed. It has very little his take on the whole thing has very little relevance to the Irish experience and to the reality of us within the EU. In actual fact, Ireland's participation in the EU has been one of the great enhancements of Irish freedom. You have no freedom unless you've got a few bob in your pocket.
Mary Regan, why do you think Nigel Farage is over here? Do you think he's if as John says, his opinion, his views have no real relevance to the Irish experience, what's he doing?
Well, look, I assume he knows that when he comes here, he'll, you know, grab a lot of attention because of, you know, his method of communication is always interesting, and it is good for alternative views to be heard so long as those views are adequately challenged and tested. But I just, you know, listening to him this morning, I think he really didn't know or understand what audience audience he was speaking to at all. He was trying to portray, you know, Irish people as being in some way imposed upon by the EU, trying to stir up this sort of anti-establishment sentiment, you know, maybe a bit of the Trump effect or the Brexit effect in Ireland. Whereas I think that really is to misunderstand the Irish electorate, which has proven itself to be far less volatile than other, you know, other countries, especially throughout the years of recession. Our political earthquake was the 2011 election when Fianna Fáil got, you know, halfway wiped out. Then the next general election where the same happened to Fine Gael. And I think the only big, you know, political earthquakes in this country have happened within that 2.5 party system, with Sinn Féin maybe replacing Labour Party as the third biggest party. But I think in his efforts to stir up this anti-establishment sentiment here, he really didn't get Ireland. And I think if we were looking for leadership, political leadership on any issue in this country, we certainly wouldn't be looking to anyone in the UK to provide it for us.
Michael, you wanted to come in there.
Yeah, one of the things, Nigel Farage has stood for the House of Commons I don't know how many times and never got elected. He's an MEP, and I've seen the turnout rates in the MEP elections in the UK at less than 20%.
Yeah, but that's a lot of that has to do with the political system that is in place in the UK.
No, I know that. But last week, the Brexit committee from the House of Commons visited the Oireachtas, and they met with members of the Oireachtas. 2 months ago, the Brexit committee visited Northern Ireland and visited South Armagh, and they are engaging in a really good way to try and see how they can impact and how they can influence the government of the UK. The government of the UK are in absolute turmoil on this, unfortunately. And I'm hopeful that at some stage a bit of common sense will prevail, because there needs to be a deal. Ireland supports and has been pushing to try and see will the UK stay in the customs union and the single market. It's the only common sense thing to do. For the UK, they have 50% of their trade with the EU 27 countries, seven of their top 10 trading partners are in a free trade arrangement agreement area that is the EU. To do what they're doing really is not a clever thing. And was there a vote up? I'm sure there was, but the vote was a tight vote, and a lot of people are going to be disengaged, a lot of jobs going to be lost because of this. And we saw from the leaked papers from the British departments last week, from what we have seen of the ones that were leaked, you know, in all likelihood, the economy is going to be deeply impacted by this.
One of the points that kind of went under the radar this week, John Downing, is that it now looks like Britain is determined to leave the customs union, and our own commissioner, Phil Hogan, saying that, you know, we're going to have some kind of a border.
Yeah, he was speaking on Thursday, and he struck a very pessimistic tone on the, as long as Britain persists in wanting to leave the customs union and the single market, it looks increasingly inevitable that there will be some kind of border, some kind of checks on both people and goods on this island.
Roisin Shortall, are you confident that the government here is taking the right approach by nailing its colours to the European mast, it's taking the side of Brussels and allowing the negotiation to be led from that side, as opposed to maybe trying to soften the stance with the UK, because a good deal for the UK would ultimately be better for trade here?
I must say, I think the Irish government needs to be a lot more robust in its dealings with Europe on Brexit. You know, the December agreement was very much welcomed at the time, but it was full of aspiration. And, you know, nobody has squared that circle of how do you deal with the situation where, you know, Britain wants out of the single market and the customs union. And yet, you know, that would be disastrous for us. We don't want a hard border. So how do you, they're two opposing positions, and how do you resolve that? So, like, the aspirations of the December agreement need to be translated into kind of hard agreements. And it's not clear that that's going to be possible at this stage. And I know that the government has started to make contingency plans for a hard Brexit, because increasingly, unfortunately, it's looking like that. So, you know, it's fine to say yes in December. The other 26 were very supportive of Ireland's unique position. But will that translate into actually them standing up for Ireland when it comes to doing deals on it? And my concern is that over the coming months, there's going to be a lot of other issues brought into the debate. You know, there are concerns in many European countries about the future of Europe, the future shape of Europe. And I would be concerned that Ireland's interests would be diluted within that
context. But Russian seems to be ignoring that the common travel agreement area has been concluded. The Good Friday Agreement has been protected. Within phase one, we've agreed that there won't be a hard border, that we'll have regulatory alignment.
But we still don't know what soft border means, though.
We won't have a hard border. So that's for the British.
But how does that work then, Michael? Well, nobody has explained can work.
We have been very clear on that, Roisin. There will be regulatory alignment between Ireland and Northern Ireland. Now, that's going to create a difficulty, potentially, for the British to resolve between Northern Ireland and the UK mainland. But that's what they've agreed to. That's what Theresa May, Prime Minister,
that's
signed up to.
That's the aspiration that's
no,
there.
No, sorry. That's what the government have agreed to. So if that's going to get thrown out the window when we're in phase two, well, sure, there is no agreement. But there are agreements. So you can't just ignore that the agreements...
But there's no detail, Michael. There's no detail.
Of course there will be detail to be
we
concluded.
We need detail. It's a bit like the previous debate. You need detail in that debate.
There will be detail, but the government achieved something very important with the support of the EU27. And that was a really major achievement by the government of Ireland, Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney.
Billy Kelleher, are you happy that the government is taking the right approach in aligning itself with the negotiations which are being led from Brussels as opposed to from here?
Well, it's just a treaty reality that, I mean, the EU will negotiate with a third member or a third country on our behalf, and that's the same as in the context of the withdrawal of the UK. My major concern will be that Brexit fatigue would set into the European Union as well. And that, you know, over time, as you have changes in terms of national governments across Europe, that, you know, they may just have less commitment to trying to address all the problems that, you know, the island could encounter if there is a hard Brexit. And, you know, we could end up in a very difficult position. But, I mean, we do have to keep lines of communication open with the British government. That is critically important. But regarding Nigel Farage, let's be very clear. I mean, like, look, I find his commentary, by and large, you know, entertaining but quite nasty when you strip it all away. The reason there's no debate in this country with regard to the European Union is that all political parties are signed up to the European Union. By and large, we've had the referendum on numerous occasions. And any time we actually rejected a referendum in this country, it wasn't about leaving the European Union. The concern sometimes in this country is that we are worried maybe about more federal type Europe. So the European Union should be a community of nations rather than going to this nation of communities.
Michael, you want to get in?
Yeah,
briefly
just one of the things that the MPs from the Brexit Committee have, they've done an awful lot of work, as I said earlier. But one of the things that has really surprised them has been in their travels all around Europe is the unified approach that has been taken to date by the European nations and the Commission and the Parliament. And in a funny and an unusual, perverse sort of a way, the Brexit vote has actually pulled Europe tighter together than ever before.
I think it's important to point out that because the negotiations are being led by Michel Barnier, that we won't necessarily have control over that. I mean, we talk about this being our border, but that, you know, the northern border is going to become an EU border.
Yeah.
And that will, you know, the terms of that and how that will operate will be dictated by the EU. And Michel Barnier has said this from the beginning. He can deal with, you know, common travel, the common travel area, the movement of people and services. But the big problem is in relation to the movement of goods, and that hasn't been resolved.
There was a really important moment, and that was when Donald Tusk said that the Irish position would be the EU position, and that is something that you can't ignore either, Maureen.
All right, I'm going to take a break there. When we come back, we're going to be discussing the case for trauma services in the west of Ireland and rural broadband. Welcome back to Saturday with Justin McCarthy. Now, just a couple of texts and tweets in. One texter saying there's already confusion about the referendum. This is on the Eighth Amendment. Publication of draft legislation may well increase that confusion. And another saying, I can't vote to repeal for various reasons, but mainly because I don't want politicians making the decision on this issue. It has to remain in the Constitution, says one texter. Now, one decision that politicians will make is... what services go to rural Ireland, and there's been a lot of focus this week on rural Ireland and the decision of AIR to pull out of the National Broadband Plan and the handling of that by Minister Dennis Nocton. But there's also another urban-rural issue facing the government in the coming days. Next week, the Health Minister, Simon Harris, is going to bring proposals to Cabinet to locate two major trauma care centres in Dublin and Cork. Now, this has led to tensions in government, with two ministers, Michael Ring and Dennis Nocton, raising concerns that the west of Ireland may be neglected, and they want a major centre to be located in Galway. Trauma care deals with patients who've experienced things like car crashes, head injuries and broken limbs. Roisin Shortall, I'll come to you on this first. Is this a case where politicians have to make some tough decisions and accept that if you do want top class facilities, that you can't have them everywhere in the country?
Yeah, I think these are very difficult decisions, and I think politicians need to be guided by the expert opinion on this in relation to, particularly in health, where there's a need for a critical mass in order to have high quality services and to have the best kind of health outcomes. The difficulty is in doing any of this rationalisation within the health service is that there's very little trust on the part of the public in what politicians do about health services. And too often in the past, decisions have been made to rationalise services based on a need to save money. And it shouldn't be about that whatsoever. It should be about ensuring that people have the best kind of access to the best kind of services, given our small population and the dispersed population.
And do you accept that is what is at issue here, is that if you do have a car crash and you need, maybe you have a brain injury, that you need to go to an expert centre where the top clinicians are working, and you can't have those scattered all over the country. You can't.
Absolutely. And I think the evidence will show that where you have access to a centre of excellence like that, that your chances of recovery, of being saved and recovering well, are improved greatly. And I think that information has to be got out to people. But the other thing about this is that, you know, there is a long history there of services being closed and the promised replacement services not materialising. And the other thing, of course, in relation to speedy access to high quality services is the need to have a really top quality ambulance service, both an air ambulance yes. service and a regular ambulance service. And again, we've seen in the past where they have been promised and they haven't materialised. So that's why, you know, if the public is to have confidence in what the government is doing in relation to centres of excellence, they need to put in those kind of support services first, get the good, you know, the top quality services operating, and then the people will buy into that.
Yes.
The public will believe that this is in their interests, but too often it hasn't worked out like that.
The Department of Health has said that it's important to point out that what's being proposed does not recommend removing services from hospitals in the West or elsewhere around the country, except in Dublin, where there is a consensus, including among clinicians, that a reconfiguration is needed. Michael Darcy, you want to get in?
Yeah, can
that?
I give you just a good... I don't like to be putting statistics out upon health cases, but 45% of brain injury cases are not admitted to a hospital with a neurological unit. So really the objective here is people who need the right level of care are brought to the right type of hospital immediately.
But isn't the point that Michael Ring and Dennis Nocton are making is that if you have an accident in Mayo or in Donegal or in Roscommon, that the time it'll take to get you to hospital in Dublin or Cork is you know, potentially impact on your care.
Yeah, but you have to be transferred from there anyway. And the point that I'm making about it is this is the level above the emergency department, above a tertiary level hospital. So it's the next level up is where people need to get to quicker, faster and better. And Roisin has touched upon it. The ambulance service has to be up to standard, as well as the air services, that if the people are that bit further away, they need to be brought to the right hospital as quickly as is possible.
Billy Keller, I mean, you'll be happy enough there'll be a centre in Cork according to Simon Harris's plan, but what would you say to Michael Ring and to Dennis Nocton, who are raising their concerns about the services that are being provided for people in the west of Ireland?
Yeah, well, I mean, the legitimate concerns, I think the biggest point, and Roisin made it, is the distrust that's out there among communities with regard to reconfiguration. Reconfiguration has always been a coded word for reducing services. What this is proposing, from what I can get, I haven't seen the report, is that this would enhance the services. So people would actually go to the right hospital at the right time in the event of a major trauma. Now, from what I do know is, I mean, some of the hospitals don't have neurological teams in place. So, I mean, regardless, they may be taken to a hospital, but they'll be taken to the wrong hospital. So we have to, I think, look at the experts, see what the report recommends. But by and large, you know, experts should be the ones that dictate what type of services are in place, rather than politicians playing local politics for local gain. And that sometimes is to the detriment. And if you look at today's statistics, for example, with regard to cancer, the cancer care strategy was a national strategy. It was unpopular politically, but it came with the right outcomes in the long term for patients.
Okay. All right. OK, well, that is our lot for today. My thanks to my panel, Billy Kelleher, Michael Darcy, Roisin Shortall, John Downing and Mary Regan. I'm back again next week. Until then, thanks for listening and have a very good afternoon.